Hi to everyone, welcome to the Bold Scientist Under the Shower. This is the our Christmas show. So I will just remind you that the Bold Scientist Under the Shower is on air every second Tuesday of the month. Today is the 11th of December. We have a Christmassy guest with us. She's obviously a scientist. She's not bold. I mean, bold. She's B-O-L-D. She's not B-A-L-D because she's a beautiful woman here. Annalisa Bellizza with us, talking about science and technology study. Hi, Annalisa, how are you doing?
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Very honored to be here.
And so tell us a little bit about yourself. So tell us, I know that you're not fully, so you just started your academic career 5 years ago.
I covered it, yeah.
Yes, and but you started from somewhere else. So tell us a little bit about you, yourself.
Okay, yeah. I had the privilege to experiment with different jobs before recovering an academic trajectory. Until almost 6 years ago, I was working for government or for a telecommunication company in government.
What was that?
As a project leader of large scale IT infrastructures.
And where?
That was in Italy.
Okay. Because you are Italian, so yeah. We forgot. Yeah. We forgot to mention that, very important.
Oh, so the passport says. So that was my postdoc experience, let's put it that way, which gave me the opportunity to discover a world that I wouldn't have been able to know otherwise, which is the governmental environment, developing data infrastructure, large scale data infrastructures.
Okay.
And in that capacity, I developed some research lines that I realized I wanted to further develop in a proper academic environment. And that's how I, basically applied for European grants, which brought me here to the Netherlands, more than 5 years ago, at the University of Twente.
Okay.
In the East, where, I was welcomed by colleagues at the Department of Science, Technology and Policy Studies.
How is working in the Netherlands, Annalisa?
I just worked there, actually,
okay.
So I don't have many experiences, many other experiences, but working with my colleagues there at STEPS was great. I must say that I felt more welcome than anywhere else.
Okay.
I can witness that Dutch colleagues can be very warm.
Okay, great. No, I have the same experience. So, completely agree.
Yeah. I joined the department, which is internationally known as Department for, as I said, Science, Technology and Policy Studies, which bring together the science technology studies and the innovation studies research traditions. Basically, science technology studies is a meta discipline, is a field, if you want, where two analytical tools used by analytical tools developed by sociology, history, philosophy, anthropology as well, are used in order to focus on scientific or technological technological development.
Okay.
And this tradition that started in the late 60s, early 70s was also encountered innovation studies in the last decade. So basically it has to do with the embedding of scientific and technological innovation in society.
Okay. So but what exactly actually your research focus on? So what is exactly this technology study applied to?
Technology studies can be applied to all technologies.
Yeah.
In my specific case, I'm interested in data infrastructures.
Okay. So what exactly, I guess that our radio listener are not really familiar about data infrastructure. So which type of data? So let's put it like that. Which type of data exactly? I mean, not necessarily what are the type of data you manage or you like to investigate?
Yeah. More than on data, I focus on how data are organized.
Okay.
Collected, circulated, and shared. I'm particularly interested in data about populations.
Okay. Great.
So, to give a very easy example, in the Netherlands, it has to do with the GBA, the Gemeentelijke Basis Administratie. And I also work on data about territory and space. So, for example, in the Netherlands, I did research about the Dutch cadaster. Why? Because population and territory are the two assets of the nation state. If we adopt a historical perspective, then we can see that the nation state didn't exist before the 16th, 17th century.
Okay.
There were other forms of social order. The nation state emerged as a form to handle data.
Yeah, because sorry if I interrupt you.
Sure.
Because we always encounter in the newspapers and news some fake news as well. So the fact we are not really trusting our governments. I'm talking about Italy because it's the closest example I have. Because we fear or we feel that the governments are not really capable to manage the all those data about territories and population. But actually, so you're just telling me that is not true, because the definition of a state, it is based on data managing.
Well, if you look at history, there are those scholars who make the point that the nation state, the modern nation state, emerged as a kind of machine to handle data. So not so much the state, it was not the case so much that the state was there and data were something the state had to deal with, but rather the opposite. In order to collect and properly manage data, an organizational bureaucratic machine had to be created.
So let me understand. So the king, let's say the king, probably in France, I don't know, just an example, was not really aware or was not really in possess of those data. That's what you are telling me. Before, yeah. Of course, the born of this state nation. Was it the case? So was not.
Yeah.
And who was it instead? Who was the owner of those data back then?
We might talk about what is data, because by definition, data is something which is there, objectively there. But the point is that if you don't have someone who take measures and put these measures on paper files in this case, or nowadays on digital databases, then data, it doesn't exist. So that's what you mentioned is a very nice story by historian Chandra Mukherjee. She described how in the 17th century France, Jean-Baptiste Colbert could hire low rank bureaucrats to send them at the peripheries of what was considered to be France at that time to measure land parcels and rivers and geographical elements. And these measurements were sent back to Colbert and the central administration of the French state, thus bypassing the actors that up to that moment were in charge of these measurements and this the nobility.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Okay. So the nobility had all those information that afterwards the low class collect in a more objective way.
Well, the nobility was in control of the space.
Not necessarily measure.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So measurement is a quite crucial technology that was introduced by this bureaucratic rationale way of thinking for a form of knowledge creation. And by introducing these bureaucrats, this measurement about peripheries were created and started to constitute at least the asset of a central administration, of a central administrative power that turned out to be the French state.
Okay, in summary,
contributed to the power of the king.
So you're telling us that the state nation was born just because the king decided for the first time to bypass the nobility and sent in the periphery of the over all the country some low class people in order to get the measurements and the data, as we call it right now, and to get all the information necessary to have a bureaucracy for the first time.
Necessary to know the space.
Okay.
And to know the space, you needed to have a bureaucracy.
Okay.
So it's also this is one of this is a very good example of the interplay between technology and social order. because the by having this technological measurement, also aristocracy was bypassed, at least de facto, if not formally. And as such, also a new class of non-aristocrat could find a place in the emerging social order.
Yeah, true. Exactly. Yeah. Because, I mean, this low class became the new bureaucrats.
Yeah.
All right. So this is a bit of history, but this was kind of three hundred years ago, probably a little bit more. Now things changed. And things changed kind of significantly also because of the technology. And we're going to talk about how they changed and how they can improve in the next part of the show. Because right now I will leave you with another Italian song. The first one was Città Vuota from sang by Mina. And you will understand a bit the meaning of this this song later on. Now there is Blue Vertigo with Fuori dal Tempo.
Non posso dire tutto quello hai paura della morte.
Welcome back to A Bold Scientist Under the Shower. This was a Blue Vertigo with Fuori dal Tempo. I choose this song because there is this last part of the song that is about this form that you had to fill out when before the military service, and there are all this bunch of weird questions like do you like flowers, or you love your mother, so all bunch of weird questions that are used to categorize you in whether you are a person that can do the military service or not, which is something quite obsolete. I don't know whether it still exists, but still, it's quite in line with what we're gonna discuss about right now, because we are talking about probably not really forms, but way of categorizing people, because we are talking about, I didn't remind you, data infrastructure, and how can you manage this big amount of data related to states, basically. So now the question is kind of it's kind of natural question whether this data infrastructure to managing population and territories, like you said, can shape somehow the state nation. So depending on how you manage this data infrastructure, can change somehow the aspect of a state nation.
Absolutely.
It is so crucial. Yeah. That's actually my
In my research, I try to investigate how data architectures relate to administrative architectures.
Okay.
So we have administrative architectures that we inherited at least from the 19th century. And also after World War II, of course, there was a big fracture. So these institutional architectures are nonetheless, challenged de facto by data architectures. And this is not so surprising if you consider what I said before, that the nation state was born as a form of machine to manage, bureaucratic machine to manage information, be it analog or digital. That's not the point. So definitely the way data are collected, which type of data is collected, and how it's circulated across different actors, both government agencies, but also non-government agencies or international organizations, challenges the boundaries of what we consider to be the institutions we inherited from modernity. I can probably give you an example.
Yeah, please.
So we know that data about populations is usually managed at the local level. In the Netherlands, for example, by municipalities through the gemeentelijke basisadministratie. The project of centralizing the GBA has gone on for almost 20 years now. And it has encountered a lot of problems, as you might have read on newspapers. One reason for these problems is also that the change in the way data is circulated also entails changes in relations between different authorities. So you might have local authorities losing some tasks or some rights or some roles, like the roles of certifying the data is of good quality in favor of the state, so the central state. So de facto data architectures, when it comes to especially to interoperable systems, they change the relations between agencies, because one agency that was supposed to be the source of data can become a user of data from one day to the other. Well, not from one day to the other, but let's say de facto. So not because of changes in the law, but because of changes in the technical architecture. So we see that there are different forms of knowledge that compete when it comes to population systems, management systems, identity management systems, and in a governmental context. There might be the legal rationality, which is expressed through the law, but it might also be there is actually, there are more technical forms of rationality that are expressed through standards, protocols, technical architectures.
So basically, by law, a municipality has to be in charge of, I don't know, the data of a citizen. But I mean, due to technicality, at the end, the central government would be in charge both of the certification and of the makeup of the data.
This has been through in many European countries in the last 20 years. I can talk about Italy and the Netherlands. For example, when systems are... Yeah.
And is it, I mean, if you want to say something else about it, but is it your role in terms of as a researcher to lead the governments understand that there is this disalignment between what the law says and what the technical problems are?
Let's say in our field, we try to uncover different epistemic forms, so different forms of knowledge, and explain that what is usually called, what might be called failure, for example, and here in the Netherlands, we know a lot about it, failure in IT systems, might be a consequence of these different epistemic forms not finding ways to interact, but bringing with them different interests and different understandings. So being incommensurable.
Yeah.
So, ideally, also producing research about these topics should be useful for policymakers.
Yeah, indeed.
Whether policymakers are listening to us, that's another story, but it's also part of the skills of the new researchers to convince policymakers to listen to her or him.
In this regard, so it comes another question, because you talked about data in terms of defining population. Mm-hmm. So it confuses me a little bit. How would you first of all define population, and what is the? I mean, probably I say a word that you wouldn't like. What is the best way to do it? Mm-hmm. So. can you somehow fill up some mistake or some failure that the government might implement in this kind of population definition?
Well, let's say more than mistakes, there are different epistemological choices. They can be distinguished in two, basically. The first one is the statistical form of defining population, which is a priori, which means that I, as a statistician, assume that some classes are relevant for my analysis. So I divide populations in terms of gender, in terms of age classes, in terms of economic
status,
because in my assumptions, these are independent variables which are useful to understand the problem at hand. However, this system is usually not very generous towards hybrid cases. Or just to make an example, if I assume that people active in work are those between 25 and 65, that means that in my analysis, I want to collect data about people in their early 20s or late 60s, which means that even if these people work, they won't be represented in my analysis. So that's one of the limitations of statistical analysis. And of course, it depends on your research goals. I mean, statistical analysis can work very well for some specific questions like whether there are more men or women on which age in a, actually employed.
And now it would be a bit provocative, because yeah. You says depends on the type of research.
Yeah.
So now comes up to my mind a kind of case that probably is very hot at the moment, which is probably not easily classifiable, cases that are not easily classifiable in this a priori way. And I'm thinking about the migrants.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have example about that? So do you have example about, for instance, implication that strong implication that where the a priori classification is not good?
Yeah, definitely. So in my most recent research,
this is a very dynamic
environment. That's exactly what I'm interested in, because this a priori statistical analysis works well when you have some, you can take with a certain degree of certainty some assumptions. In the case of unknown populations, like those arriving at European borders, most assumptions can just be insufficient. So in my research, I'm conducting right now a research project on the representation of migrants as it happens through the data systems used at European borders, both by nation states and European institutions. This brought me also to observe the registration of migrants at some hotspots, which now are the centers where people are first registered and identified and then detained for a while, usually short periods. So during one of these registration moments, I noticed there was a police officer who was interviewing a woman, and he had a moment in which he was doubtful. So I asked him what was going on, and he told me, you know, this woman is declaring to be a school teacher, a school director. And I don't have this possibility on the system that I'm using to record her as a school director. It was quite surprising, because the system was really quite accurate. I mean, there were also there was a possibility to register someone as a painter, as a psychologist, but there was no possibility to register someone as a teacher or as a school director. So that was a problem for him because he couldn't.
Sorry, just yeah. question, but because those type of migrants were not supposed to be school director, how does it work? So because the migrants from that region were not supposed.
No, I mean, this system was developed at the national level, so okay. and it was deployed nationwide. No, it was. that's a curious question, because sometimes we tend to attribute to authorities more agency or more goals that they actually have. But it was, I mean, I don't have evidence of that, but definitely the system was deployed nationwide. So I wouldn't say it was on purpose. It was just they didn't realize that. And, you know.
So then that, how she was classified?
That's the interesting part, because she was classified as, her work was classified as other. So in the category other, which was a problem for the police officer, because he couldn't represent reality with a sufficient degree of granularity. It was a problem for the woman, because her working identity was basically reduced to otherness. And that's the problem, or one problem with the a priori registration of populations. So the second way to present or to identify populations is a posteriori. So instead of giving definitions, you look at how people are gathered together through the data that is collected about them. One of my arguments is that migrants as populations are created exactly by the way data infrastructures are designed. Because if you spoil, if you deprive a person, in this case a woman, from her job identity, her working identity, then she will become other.
Yeah. So you deprive her of her dignity as well.
That's a further step if you want.
That's a more ethical issue, but probably there are more practical problems.
Definitely, in a sense that her working identity won't travel with her in Europe, so it will stop at the border. And there are many of these cases, also because we should start from being clear about that. No information system is fully encompassing the identity of a person. So information systems are thought to only select some aspects of the identity of persons. Identities are two complex issues to be represented through information systems.
The reductionist approach, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. The point is how this reduction takes place.
Exactly.
If it takes place by only focusing on some aspects that characterize persons as illegal, they will become illegal.
Yeah, it's crazy.
They characterize, potentialities of contribution to a community, that will support integration. So the information system design is always a very sensitive issue, and it should be carried on by task force of people with different skills.
I also can imagine that some type of classification is typical of the person that designed those type of classification. I can imagine that migrants from Africa can define family system in a different way.
Yeah, definitely. That's why it would be very interesting to have people concerned being registered to be part of these task forces. I had an example of I was told this story of 17 African, sub-Saharan African men who declared to be siblings. And when they were asked how that was possible, they said, we left from the same village, we crossed the desert together. We went through terrible things together, and now we are here and we are still together. So we are siblings. And that was not a way to fake the system. It was really something that they wanted to be recognized. But on the other hand, the European information systems do not foresee the possibility to define family in this very encompassing way.
So I stop you here. Thank you very much for the very, also emotional stories that you are telling us that are related to your research. And I stop you here because I think that the next song that actually you choose is very much related to what you told us. This is How to Disappear Completely from Radiohead. Was Radiohead with How to Disappear Completely. So we can kind of imagine why you, Annalisa, chose this song, but we want to listen it from you. And actually, probably you're gonna be even much more specific than our imagination. So no. Please.
I would only like to recall the lyrics, a part of the lyrics, if you allow me.
Sure.
Because I can imagine I don't want to put myself in someone else's shoes, but I can imagine that these lyrics can also talk of people who are in a place that they don't expect to be, or they didn't expect to be, and they probably don't want to be seen there. This is a quotation from the lyrics. That there, that's not me. I go where I please. I walk through walls. I float down the leafy. I'm not here. This isn't happening. I'm not here. I'm not here. And then strobe lights and blown speakers, fireworks and hurricanes. I'm not here. This isn't happening. I'm not here. So this came to my mind as probably it's my interpretation, definitely. It reminded me of people I met at the borders, who didn't choose to be there, but there was no other place to be. Despite the strobe lights and the blown speakers that migration is attracting in the last years, and the fireworks and the hurricanes, they prefer to think that they are not there. And that's what is happening, is actually not happening. So that's why I choose it.
Wow. Very nice. Yeah, very nice and very... emotional, as I said before with the other story that you perfectly described. So we almost at the end we actually want to talk about many other things, first thing first, so can you kind of summarize what are the goals, the main targets of your research? So now I think the radio listeners have a general idea of what you did, what you are currently doing. But what are your targets?
Well, there are three different types of targets. The first one is the scientific community, who sometimes struggles to see the long-term implications of technological design and implementation. So the topic of my research makes it quite clear what the long-term implications might be, not only for migrants, but also for the order of authority that we know in Europe and for European integration. Because we shouldn't forget that data about non-European populations are collected both at the national level and European level. So for what we said before, that the two architectures, the data architecture and the institutional architectures, are not fully overlapping, we might look at how data is collected and circulated as a methodological entry point to explore also, or to scenarios of longer term transformations in the order of authority between nation states and Europe, also considering the role of non-governmental organizations. Contractors developing information systems, they have a huge role in the way people are represented, on one hand. On the other hand, the way people are represented also tells something about the institutions which collect data. I used to say that the stories we tell are also make us who we are. Mm-hmm. So they don't only tell a story about the object of the story, but also tell a story about who is telling, creating the story. The second community are authorities, who sometimes might not foresee the implications of their technical decisions, or might consider technical decisions as something of minor importance, once that in any way it's just an implementation of regulations. While technical decisions might bring very important decisions about the life of people.
We have the example of the school director.
The rector, exactly. And the third Well, what I wished could be a third actor in dialogue with my research are people on the move themselves, who I don't see why they might not be take part in designing systems.
And we have the 17 brothers.
And the 17 brothers, yeah. Those would be the first ones. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We actually still have some minutes, and so we one of the topic that we want to address was also related to, because you are writing, or you wrote a book.
Yeah, it's almost out.
Okay, so you have probably we have a few minutes, three minutes to talk a little bit about the content.
Yeah, that's a different story.
Yeah, yeah, I know. But I mean, I would like to use these 3 minutes to make people curious and probably invite you once again to talk a bit more extensively about this book.
Thank you. So the book is called, it's titled Communities at Crossroads, and it's published by the Institute of Network Cultures in Amsterdam. So the Institute of Network Culture is quite well-known publisher in digital studies and media theory, and also digital communities. My book is actually, let's say, a study of 1,000 digital communities which developed in the first decade of this century. So after,
what do you mean for digital communities? Just for give us some example.
So assemblages of people, but not only people.
So and Facebook is a digital community.
That's a good point. Actually, the research was written during the emergence of Web 2.0, what at the time was called Web 2.0 hype. So it was written more or less around the emergence of social media. I personally wouldn't say that it's a community, but it might allow a series of community. Facebook is a huge media corporation. Well, no, I studied digital communities, 1,000 of these spontaneous aggregations, which participated to the festival, probably the most well-known festival for digital art culture, which is the Ars Electronica in Linz, in Austria. And I was particularly interested exactly in looking at how people describe themselves as digital communities, defined what a digital community is.
Okay.
And I must say I found many different definitions.
So it's a meta perspective.
It's a meta perspective, definitely. And I found very different definitions. The interesting thing is that these communities, these 1,000 communities, were coming from 5 continents. Those who gave a more convincing definition of community were also those who described in more detail how software allowed them to be a community. So once again, software too can do things, can support people aggregating in one way and impede to aggregate in another way. So in STS we say that artifacts, in this case software, also has agency.
Yeah. Thank you very much, and unfortunately the time is up. Thank you very much, Annalisa. I really hope to invite you once again, probably to be more extensive about this 1,000 digital community and this meta perspective. Thanks again. And thank you also, Radio Onda Italiana, to host us as every second Tuesday of the month. And Merry Christmas, Annalisa.
Enjoy your break.
Yes, you too. And I leave you about Christmas with a Christmas song from Vinicio Capossela. Enjoy and see you next month.
Sei qui con me.